Kit had been on the deck for rather a long time. Heaving a sigh, Loth stood. There was no lock on the door, but he supposed there was nowhere for the pirates to lug the travelling chest of garments and other effects that had been on the coach. Coe must have sent his retainers to collect them while Loth was oblivious in the privy chamber, sharing a quiet supper with Sobran and Roslane. The air was cool above. A breeze scuffed over the waves. As the crew moved hither and thither, they bellowed a song, too quick and drenched in sea cant for Loth to understand. Despite what Harlow had said, nobody took any notice of him as he ascended to the quarter-deck. The Swan Strait divided the Queendom of Innis from the great continent that held the west and the south. Even in high summer, perishing winds blew through it from Ashen Sea. He found Kit hanging over the side, wiping vomit from his chin. "Good evening to you, sir." Loth clapped him on the back. "Did you indulge in a little pirate wine?" Kit was pale as a lily. "Arteloth," he said. "Oh, you don't think I'm at all well, you know. You need ale. I dare not ask them for it. They've been roaring like that for the whole time I've been up here."
"They're singing shanties," a husky voice said.
Loth started. A woman in a wide-brimmed black hat was leaning against the gunwale nearby. "Work songs." She tossed Kit a wineskin. "Helps the swabbers pass the time." Kit twisted off the stopper. "Did you say swabbers, mistress?"
"Them that clear the decks."
Going by her looks and accent, this privateer was from Ascalon. Deep olive skin, tanned and freckled. Hair like barley wine, eyes of a clear amber thinly outlined with black paint, the left eye underscored by a scar. She was well presented for a pirate, down to the sheen on her boots and her spotless jerkin. A rapier hung at her side.
"If I were you, I'd be back in my cabin before it gets dark," she said. "Most of the crew don't care over much for lordlings. Plume keeps them in check, but when he sleeps, so do their good manners."
"I don't believe we've made your acquaintance, mistress," Kit said. Her smile deepened.
"And what makes you think I wish to make your acquaintance, my lord nobleman?"
"Well, you did speak to us first."
"Perhaps I was bored."
"Perhaps we'll prove interesting." He bowed in his extravagant way. "I am Lord Kitson Glade, court poet, future Earl of Honeybrook to my father's chagrin. Delighted to make your acquaintance."
"Lord Arteloth Beck," Loth inclined his head. "Heir of the Earl and Countess of Goldenbirch."
The woman raised her eyebrow.
"Estina Milago, heir to my own grey heirs, bosun of the Rose Eternal."
It was clear from Kit's expression that he knew of this woman. Loth chose not to ask.
"So," Milago said, "you're heading for Cascaro?"
"Are you from that city, mistress?" Loth inquired.
"No, Bazuva."
Loth watched her drink from a glass bottle.
"Mistress," he said,
"I wonder if you could tell us what to expect in the court of King Sagoso. We know so little about what has happened in Ascalon over the last 2 years."
"I know as much as you, my lord. I fled Ascalon, along with some of the others, the day the House of Atalda announced its allegiance to the Nameless One."
Kit spoke again. "Did many of those who fled become pirates?"
"Privateers, if you please."
Milago nodded to the ensign.
"And no. Most exiles went to Mentenden, or to the Aesir to start again, as best they could. But not everyone got out."
"Is it possible that the people of Ascalon do not all bow to the Nameless One, then?" Loth asked. "That they are only afraid of their king, or trapped in their country?"
"Likely. Nobody goes out now, and very few go in. Cascaro still accepts foreign ambassadors, as evidenced by your good selves, but the rest of the country could be dead from plague, for all I know."
A curl blew across her eyes.
"If you ever get out, you must tell me what Cascaro is like now. I hear there was a great fire just before the birds flew out. Lavender fields used to grow near the capital, but they burned."
This was making Loth feel more uneasy than he had before.
"I'll confess to curiosity," Milago said, "as to why your queen is sending you into the snake pit. I thought you were a favourite of hers, Lord Arteloth."
"It is not Queen Sobran who sends us, mistress," Kit said. "But the ghastly Satan Combe," he said. "He never liked my poetry, you know. Only a soulless husk could hate poetry."
"Ah, the Nighthawk," Milago said, chuckling. "A suitable familiar for our queen."
Loth stilled. "What do you mean by that?"
"Saint."
Kit looked fascinated.
a heretic as well as a pirate. Do you imply that Queen Sabran is some sort of witch? Privateer, and keep your voice down. Malaga glanced over her shoulder. Don't misunderstand me, my lords. I've no personal dislike of Queen Sabran, but I come from a superstitious part of Iskallen, and there is something odd about the Berethnets. Each queen only having one child, always a daughter, and they all look so similar. I don't know. Sounds like sorcery to... Shadow! Malaga turned. The roar had come from the crow's nest. Another wyvern, she said under her breath. Excuse me. She vaulted onto the ropes and climbed. Kit ran to the side. Wyvern? Oh, I've never seen one. We don't want to see one, Loth said. His arms were prickling. This is no place for us, Kit. Come, back below deck before... Wait, Kit shielded his eyes. His curls flew in the wind. Loth, do you see that? Loth looked askance at the horizon. The sun was low and red, almost blinding him. Malaga was clinging to the ratlines, one eye to a spyglass. Mother of, she lowered it, then lifted it again. Plume, it's... I can't believe what I'm seeing.
What is it? The quartermaster called. Estina?
It's a high western. Her shout was hoarse. A high western! Those words were like a spark on kindling. Order splintered into chaos. Loth felt his legs become stone. High western. Ready the harpoons, the chain shot, a Mentish woman called. Prepare for heat. Do not engage unless it attacks. When he saw it, Loth turned cold to the marrow of his bones. He could not feel his hands or face. It was impossible, yet there it was.
A worm. A monstrous four-legged worm, over 200 feet long from its snout to the tip of its tail. This was no wyverling prowling for livestock. This was a breed that had not been seen in centuries, since the last hours of the grief of ages. Mightiest of the draconic creatures, the High Westerns, largest and most brutal of all the dragons, the dread lords of wormkind. One of them had woken. The beast glided above the ship. As it passed, Loth could smell the heat inside it, the reek of smoke and brimstone. The bear trap of its mouth, the hot coals of its eyes. They wrote themselves into his memory. He had heard stories since he was a child, seen the hideous illustrations that lurked in the bestiaries. But even his most harrowing nightmares had never conjured such a soul-fearing thing.
Do not engage! The Ment called again. Steady!
Loth pressed his back against the main mast. He could not deny what his eyes could see. This creature might not have the red scales of the Nameless One, but it was of his like. The crew moved like ants fleeing water, but the worm appeared to have its mind set on another course. It soared over the Swan Strait. Loth could see the fire pulsing inside it, down the length of its throat to its belly. Its tail was edged with spines and ended in a mighty lash. Loth caught the gunwale to hold himself upright. His ears were ringing. Close by, one of the younger seafarers was trembling all over, standing in a dark gold pool. Harlow had emerged from his cabin. He watched the High Western leave them behind.
"You had better start praying for salvation, my lords," he said softly. "Fyrdell, the right wing of the Nameless One, appears to have woken from his sleep."
Chapter 8. East. Sulliard snored. Yet another reason Trude had been a fool to pledge herself to him. Not that Nicolaes would have been able to sleep, even if his guest had shut up, for a typhoon had blown in. Thunder rumbled, making a hoarse whinny outside. Drunk on a single cup of wine, Sulliard slept through it all. Nicolaes lay on his bedding, slightly drunk himself. He and Sulliard had spent the evening playing cards and exchanging stories. Sulliard had told the gloomy tale of the Never Queen, while Nicolaes chose the more uplifting charms of Carbuncle and Scald. He still had no liking for Sulliard, but he owed it to Trude to protect her secret companion. He owed it to Janart. Jan. The vice of grief snapped closed around his heart. He shut his eyes, and he was back to that autumn morning when they had met for the first time in the rose garden of Brigstad Palace, when the court of the newly crowned Edvard II was ripe with opportunity. In his early 20s, when he was still the Marquess of Zierdur, Janart had been tall and striking, with magnificent red hair that rippled to the small of his back. In those days, Nicolay's had been one of the few mints to have a mane of fairest auburn, more gold than copper. That was what had drawn Janart to him that day. Rose gold, he had dubbed it. He had asked Nicolay's if he might paint his portrait, thus capturing the shade for posterity, and Nicolay's, like any vain young courtier, had only been too pleased to oblige. Red hair and a rose garden, that was how it had begun. They had spent the whole season together, with the easel and music and laughter for company. Even after the portrait was finished, they had stayed joined at the hip. Nicolay's had never been in love before. It was Janart who had been intrigued enough to paint him. But soon, Nicolay's had longed for the ability to paint him in return so that he might capture the darkness of those lashes and how the sun glowed in his hair and the elegance of his hands on the harpsichord. He had gazed at his silken lips and the place where his neck met his jaw. He had watched his blood throbbing there in that cradle of life. He had imagined, in exhilarating detail, how his eyes would look in the morning light when sleep made their lids heavy. That exquisite dark amber, like the honey made by black bees. He had lived to hear that voice, deep and mellow. Oh, he could sing ballads of its tenor, and the way it climbed to the height of passion when the conversation leaned towards art or history. Those subjects had set a fire in Janart, drawing people to its warmth. With words alone, he could beautify the dullest object or bring civilizations rising from the dust. For Nicolay's, he had been a sunray, illuminating every facet of his world. He had known there was no hope. After all, Janart was a marquis, heir to a duchy, the dearest friend of Prince Edvard, while Nicolay's was an upstart from Rosenton. And yet, Janart had seen him. He had seen him, and he had not looked away. Outside the house, the waves crashed on the fence again. Nicolay's turned onto his side, aching all over. "Jan," he said softly, "when did we get so old?" The Mentis shipment was due any day now, and when it turned homeward, Sulliard would be with them. A few more days, and Nicolay's would be rid of this living reminder of Trude and Janart and the saint-forsaken Inish court. He would go back to tinkering with potions in his jailhouse at the edge of the world, exiled and unknown. At last, he dozed off, cradling the pillow to his chest. When he stirred awake, it was still dark, but the hairs on his neck stood to attention. He sat up, peering into the black. "Sulliard?" No reply. Something moved in the darkness. "Sulliard, is that you?" When the lightning cast the silhouette into relief, he stared at the face in front of him. "Honored chief officer," he croaked, but he was already being towed out of bed. Two sentinels bundled him towards the door. In the chokehold of terror, he somehow snatched his cane from the floor and swung with all his might. It cracked like a whip into one of their cheeks. He only had a moment to relish his accuracy before he was struck back with an iron truncheon. He had never felt so much pain at once. His bottom lips split like fruit. Every tooth trembled in its socket. His stomach heaved at the coppery tang on his tongue. The sentinel raised his truncheon again and dealt him a terrible blow to the knee. With a cry of mercy, Nicolay's raised his hands over his head, dropping the cane. A leather boot snapped in two. Blows rained down from all sides, striking his back and his face. He fell onto the mats, making weak sounds of submission and apology. The house was being pulled to shreds around him. The din of breaking glass came from the workroom. His apparatus, worth more coin than he would ever have again. "Please!" Blood slathered down his chin. "Honored sentinels, please! You don't understand the work!" Ignoring his pleas, they marched him into the storm. All he wore was his nightshirt. His ankle was too tender to carry him, so they hauled him like a sack of millet. The few mints who worked through the night were emerging from their dwellings.
"Dr. Roos!"
one of them called.
"What's happening?"
Nicolay's gasped for breath.
"Who's that?"
His voice was lost to the sound of thunder.
"Moused!"
he shouted thickly.
"Moused! Help me, you fox-haired fool!"
A hand covered his bloody mouth. He could hear Sulliard now, somewhere in the darkness, crying out,
"Nicolay's!"
He looked up, expecting to see Moused, but it was Panier who ran into the fray. She somehow got between the sentinels and stood before Nicolaes like the knight of courage. "If he is under arrest," she said, "then where is your warrant from the honored governor of Cape Hissen?" Nicolaes could have kissed her. The chief officer was standing nearby, watching the sentinels ransack the house.
"Go back inside," he said to Pania, not looking at her.
"The learned Dr. Roos deserves respect. If you harm him, the High Prince of Mintendon will hear of it."
"The Red Prince has no power here."
Pania squared up to him. Nicolaes could only watch in awe as the woman in a sleep robe faced down the man in armor.
"While the Mintish live here, they have the all-honored warlord's protection," she said. "What will he say when he hears that you spilled blood in Orisima?"
At this, the chief officer stepped closer to her.
"Perhaps he will say that I was too merciful," he said, voice thick with contempt. "For this liar has been hiding a trespasser in his home."
Pania fell silent, shock writ plain on her.
"Pania," Nicolaes whispered, "I can explain this."
"Nicolaes," she breathed. "Oh, Nicolaes, you have defied the great edict."
His ankle throbbed.
"Where will they take me?"
Pania glanced nervously towards the chief officer, who was bellowing at his sentinels.
"To the honored governor of Cape Hissen. They will suspect you of having the red sickness," she murmured in Mentish.
Suddenly she tensed.
"Did you touch him?"
Nicolaes thought back, frantic.
"No," he said. "No, not his bare skin." "You must tell them so. Swear it on your saint," she told him. "If they suspect you are deceiving them, they will do all they can to wrest the truth from you."
"Torture?"
Sweat was beading on his face.
"Not torture. You don't mean torture, do you?"
"Enough,"
the chief officer barked.
"Take this traitor away."
With that, the sentinels carried Nicolaes off like meat for the chop.
"I want a lawyer," he shouted. "Damn you, there must be a decent bloody lawyer somewhere on this saint-forsaken island."
When nobody responded, he called up desperately to Pania.
"Tell Mouse to mend my apparatus. Continue the work."
She looked on, helpless.
"And protect my books. For the love of the saint, save my books, Pania."
Chapter 9. West. I suppose one cannot often go for walks like this in the Aesir. The heat would be intolerable. They were walking in the privy garden. Eid had never entered it before. This retreat was reserved for the pleasure of the queen, her ladies of the bedchamber, and the Virtues Council. Lady Arbella Glen was still confined to bed. The court was alive with whispers. If she died, then a new lady of the bedchamber would be needed. The other ladies of the privy chamber were already striving to showcase their wit and talent to Sabran. No doubt it was why Lenora had been so vexed when Eard had, in her eyes, botched the storytelling. She had not wanted her chances dented by association. "Not in winter. In summer we wear loose silks to stave off the heat," Eard answered. "When I lived in His Excellency's estate in Ramalabar, I would often sit by the pool in the courtyard and read. There were sweet lemon trees to shade the walkways, and fountains to cool the air. It was a peaceful time." In truth, she had only been there once. She had spent her childhood in the priory.
"I see."
Sabran held an ornate fan. "And you would pray to the Dawn Singer?"
"Yes, madame, in a house of silence."
They wandered into one of the orchards, where the green gauge trees were in full bloom. 12 knights of the body followed at a distance. Over the last few hours, Eid had discovered that beneath her all-knowing exterior, the Queen of Innis had a circumscribed view of the world. Sealed behind the walls of her palace, her knowledge of the land beyond Innis came from the wooden globes and letters from her ambassadors and fellow sovereigns. She was fluent in Iskali and Hrothi, and her tutors had educated her in the history of Virtudom, but she knew little of anywhere else. Eid could sense that she was straining not to ask questions about the South. The Aesir did not adhere to the six virtues. Neither did its neighbour, the domain of Lassia, despite its important place in the Innish founding legend. Eid had undergone her public conversion to the six virtues not long after she came to court. One spring evening, she had stood in the Sanctuary Royal, proclaimed her allegiance to the House of Berethnet, and received the spurs and girdle of a worshipper of Galleon. In return, she was promised a place in Halgallant, the heavenly court. She had told the Arch-Centurion that before her arrival in Innes, she had believed in the Dawnsinger, the most widely followed deity in the Aesir. No one had ever questioned it. Eärd had never followed the Dawnsinger. Though she had Aesiri blood, she had not been born in the Aesir and had not often set foot in it. Her true creed was known only to the Priory. "His Excellency told me that your mother was not from the Aesir," Sebran said. "No, she was born in Lassia." "What was her name?"
"Zala."
"I am sorry for your loss."
"Thank you, madam," Eärd said. "It was a long time ago."
No matter the differences between them, they both knew what it was to lose a mother. As the clock tower struck 11, Sebran stopped beside her private aviary. She unlatched the door, and a tiny green bird hopped onto her wrist. "These birds are from the Aluma Mountains," she said. Sunlight danced in the emeralds round her neck. "They often spend their winters here." "Have you ever been to Lassia, Majesty?" Eärd asked. "No, I could never leave Virtudom." Eärd felt that familiar twist of irritation. It was hypocrisy at its finest for the Innish to use Lassia as a cornerstone of their founding legend, only to deride its people as heretics. "Of course," she said. Sebran glanced at her. She took a pouch from her girdle and poured a few seeds into her palm. "In Innes, this bird is called the Love Jay," she said. The bird on her wrist gave a merry chirp. "They take only one partner all their lives, and will know their song, even after many years apart. That is why the Love Jay was sacred to the Knight of Fellowship. These birds embody the desire for every soul to be joined in companionship." "I know them well," Eärd said. The bird pecked up the seeds. "In the south, they are called peach-faced mimics."
"Peach-faced?"
"A peach is a sweet orange fruit, madam, with a stone at its core. It grows in the Aesir and some parts of the east." Sebran watched the bird eat. "Let us not speak of the east," she said, and returned it to its perch. The sun was hot as a stove, but the queen showed no sign of wanting to go inside. They continued their stroll down a path, flanked by cherry trees.
"Do you smell smoke, mistress?"
Sebran asked. "That is the smell of a fire in the city. This morning, two doomsingers were burned in Marion Square. Do you think that this is well?" There were two kinds of heretic in Innes. A scattered few still followed the primordial religion of Innes, a form of nature worship that had been practiced before the foundation of the House of Berethnet, in the days when knighthood was still young and the country had been haunted by the Lady of the Woods. They could recant or be imprisoned. Then there were those who prophesied the return of the Nameless One. For the last 2 years, these doomsingers had trickled to Innes from Iskallen and preached in the cities for as long as they could. They were burned by decree of the Duchess of Justice. "It is a cruel death," Eärd said. "They would see Innes consumed by the flame. They would have us open our arms to the Nameless One, to take him as our god. Lady Igraine says that we must do to our enemies what they would do to us."
"Did the saint also say this, madam?" Eärd asked calmly.
"I am not as well versed in the six virtues as yourself. The Knight of Courage commands us to defend the faith. Yet you accept a gift from the Prince Arbrecht of Mentendon, who trades with the East. He even gave you an Eastern pearl," Eärd said. "One might say that he is funding heresy."
It was out before she could stop it.
Sebran gave her a glacial look. "I am not a Sanctarian, responsible for teaching you the complexities of the six virtues," she said. "If you wish to dispute those complexities, Mistress Durian, I advise you to look elsewhere. In the Dern Tower, perhaps, with others who question my judgment, which comes, as I am sure I need not remind you, from the saint himself." She turned away. "Good morrow." She strode away, shadowed by her knights of the body, leaving Eärd alone beneath the trees. When the queen was out of sight, Eärd crossed the lawn and sat on the edge of a fountain, cursing herself. The heat was making her irrational. She splashed her face with the water and then drank it from cupped palms. Watched by a statue of Carnelian the First, the flower of Ascalon, fourth queen of the House of Berethnet,
Soon the dynasty would have ruled Innes for 1,006 years.
Eid closed her eyes and let the runnels of water trickle down her neck. 8 years she had spent at the court of Sobran the Ninth. In all that time, she had never said anything to nettle her. Now she was like a viper, unable to keep her tongue in her mouth. Something made her want to rile the Queen of Innes. She had to cut that something out, or this court would eat her whole. Her duties that day went by in a haze. The warmth made their errands all the harder. Even Lenora was subdued, her golden hair dampened by sweat, and Rosalind Crest spent the afternoon fanning herself with rising fury. After supper, Ead joined the other women in the Sanctuary of Virtues for orisons. The Queen Mother had ordered that blue stained glass windows be set into the hall to make it look as if it had been built underwater. There was one statue in the sanctuary, on the right side of the altar. Galleon Barethnet, his hands folded on the hilt of Ascalon. On the left, there was only a plinth in memory of the woman the Innish knew as Queen Cleolind, the damsel. The Innish had no record of what Cleolind had looked like. All images of her, if they had ever existed, had been destroyed after her death, and no Innish sculptor had ever attempted to create a likeness since. Many believed it was because King Galleon had been unable to bear seeing the woman he had lost to the childbed. Even the Priory had only a few accounts of the mother. So much had been destroyed or lost. As the others prayed, so too did Eid. Mother, I beg you, guide me in the land of the deceiver. Mother, I implore you, let me comport myself with dignity in the presence of this woman who calls herself your descendant, who I have sworn to guard. Mother, I pray you, give me the courage worthy of my cloak. Sobran rose and touched the statue of her forbear. As she and her ladies filed from the sanctuary, Eid caught sight of Trute. She was looking straight ahead, but her hands were clasped a little too tightly. When night fell, and she had seen to her duties in the Queen Tower, Eid descended the privy stair to the postern, where the barges brought goods to the palace from the city, and waited in an alcove that held the well. Trude Utzidia joined her, cloaked and hooded. "I am forbidden to be out of the coffer chamber after dark without a chaperone." She tucked a wayward lock of red into her hood. "If Lady Oliver discovers I am gone..." "You met your lover many times, my lady, presumably," Eid said, "without a chaperone." Dark eyes watched from beneath the hood. "What is it you want?" "I want to know what you and Sulliard were planning. You reference a task in your letters." "It is none of your concern. Permit me, then, to present a theory. I have seen enough to know that you take an unusual interest in the East. I think you and Sulliard meant to cross the abyss together for some mischievous purpose, but he went ahead without you. Am I wrong?" "You are. If you must continue to meddle, then you may hear the truth." Trude sounded almost bored. "Triam has gone to the Milk Lagoon. We mean to live together as companions, where neither Queen Sobran nor my father can take issue with our marriage. Do not lie to me, my lady. You show an innocent face to the court, but I think you have another." The postern opened. They pressed themselves deeper into the alcove as a guard came through with a torch, whistling. She marched up the privy stair without seeing them. "I must go back to the coffer chamber," Trude said under her breath. "I had to find 16 comfits for that loathsome bird. It will raise a stink if I am gone for long." "Tell me what you are plotting with Sulliard, then. And if I do not tell you?" Trude let out a huff of laughter. "What will you do, Mistress Durian?" "Perhaps I will tell the principal secretary that I suspect you of conspiring against Her Majesty. Remember, child, that I have your letters." "Or perhaps," Eid said, "I must use other means to make you talk." Trude narrowed her eyes.
"This is not courteous speech," she said softly. "Who are you? Why do you take such an interest in the secrets of the Innish court?"
Caution flashed across her face.
"Are you one of Combe's intelligences? Is that it?"
"I hear he makes spies of the basest sorts."
"All you need to know is that I make it my business to protect Her Majesty."
"You are a chamberer, not a knight of the body. Haven't you some sheets to strip?"
Eid stepped closer. She was half a head taller than Trude,
whose hand now strayed to the knife on her girdle.
"I may not be a knight," Eid said, "but when I came to this court, I swore that I would protect Queen Sabran from her enemies."
"And I took the same oath," said Trude hotly.
"I am not her enemy, and neither are the people of the East. They despise the Nameless One, as we do.
The noble creatures they worship are nothing like worms." She drew herself up. "Draconic things are waking, Eid. Soon they will rise. The Nameless One and his servants. Their wrath will be terrible. And when they rally against us, we will need help to fight them."
A chill went through Eid.
"You want to broker a military alliance with the East," she murmured. "You want to call their worms to help us deal with the awakenings."
Trude stared her out, her eyes bright. "Fool. Headstrong fool. When the Queen discovers you wish to deal with worms, they are not worms. They are dragons. And they are gentle creatures. I have seen pictures of them. Read books about them.
Eastern books. Yes. Their dragons are one with the air and water, not with fire. The East has been estranged from us for so long that we have forgotten the difference."
When Eid only looked at her in disbelief, Trude tried a different track.
"As a fellow outsider in this country, hear me. What if the Inish are wrong, and the continuation of the House of Berethnet is not what keeps the Nameless One at bay? What are you prattling about, child?"
"You know something has changed. The draconic creature's awakening, the breaking away of Iskallen from Virtudom, these events are only the beginning." Her voice dropped low.
"The Nameless One is coming back, and I believe he is coming soon."
For a moment, Eid was speechless.
"What if the continuation of the House of Berethnet is not what keeps the Nameless One at bay?"
How had a young woman of Virtudom come to this heretical conclusion? Of course, she might well be right. The prioress had said as much to Eid before she came to Innis, explaining why her sister must be sent to guard Queen Sabran.
"The House of Berethnet may protect us from the Nameless One, or it may not. There is no proof either way. Just as there is no proof to say whether the Berethnet queens are indeed descendants of the Mother. If they are, their blood is sacred and it must be protected."
She could see the prioress now, clear as spring water.
"That is the problem with stories, child. The truth in them cannot be weighed."
That was why Eid had been sent to Innis, to protect Sabran, in case the myth was true, and her blood would prevent the enemy rising.
"And you mean us to prepare for his second coming?" Eid said, feigning amusement.
Trude lifted her chin. "I do. The Easterners have many dragons that live alongside humans, that do not answer to the Nameless One," she said. "When he returns, we will need those Eastern dragons to defeat him. We must stand together to prevent a second grief of ages. Triam and I will not let humankind walk to its extinction. We may be small, and we may be young, but we will shake the world for our beliefs."
Whatever the truth, this girl had swallowed the torch of delusion.
"How is it you are so certain that the Nameless One will come?" Eid said. "Are you not a child of Virtudom, born to believe that Queen Sabran keeps him chained?"
Trude straightened. "I love Queen Sabran," she said, "but I am no green child to believe what I am told without proof. The Inish may have blind faith, but in Mentendon we value evidence."
"And you have evidence that the Nameless One will return, or is this guesswork?"
"Not guesswork, hypothesis."
"Whatever your hypothesis, your plot is heresy."
"Do not speak to me of heresy," Trude shot back. "Did you not once worship the Dawn Singer? My beliefs are not in question here."
Eid paused. "So that is where Celiard is gone. On some mad-born quest in the East, trying to broker an impossible alliance on behalf of a queen who knows nothing about it." She sank onto the lip of the well.
"Your lover will die in this attempt."
"No, the Cycanese will listen. He is not an official ambassador from Innis. Why ever should they hear him out? Triam will persuade them. No one speaks from the heart as he does. And once the Eastern rulers are convinced of the threat, we will go to Queen Sabran, and she will see the necessity of an alliance."
The child was blinded by her passion. Saliard would be executed the moment he set foot in the East, and Sabran would sooner cut off her own nose than strike up an alliance with worm lovers, even if she could be persuaded to believe that the Nameless One might rise while she drew breath.
"The North is weak," Trude ploughed on, and the South is too proud to treat with virtudom. Her cheeks were flushed. You dare to judge me for seeking help elsewhere? Ead looked her in the eye.
You may think yourself the one who seeks to protect this world, she said, but you have no idea of the foundation upon which you stand. None of you does.
When Trude knitted her brow, Ead said, Saliad asked for your help. What have you done to assist him from here? What plans have you made? Trude was silent.
If you have done anything to aid his mission, it is treason.
I shall not speak another word. Trude pulled away. Go to Lady Oliver if you like. First you will have to explain what you were doing in the coffer chamber.
As she made to leave, Ead closed a hand around her wrist.
You wrote a name in the book, she said. Nicleas. I think it refers to Nicleas Ruse, the anatomist.
Trude shook her head, but Ead saw the spark of recognition in her eyes.
What has Ruse got to do with all this?
Before Trude could answer, a wind rushed through the grounds. Every branch quivered on every tree. Every bird in the aviary ceased its singing. Ead released her hold on Trude and stepped out of the alcove. Cannons were firing in the city. Muskets went off with sounds like chestnuts bursting on a fire. Behind her, Trude stayed beside the well.
What is that? She said.
Ead breathed in as her blood pounded. It had been a long time since this feeling had swept through her body. For the first time in years, her Sidon had been kindled. Something was coming. If it had got this far, it must have found a way through the coastal defences, or destroyed them. A flare like the sun breaking through cloud, so hot it parched her eyes and lips, and a worm soared over the curtain wall. It burned away the archers and the musketeers, and smashed a line of catapults to splinters. Trude sank to the ground. Ead knew what it was from its magnitude alone. A high western. A monster from its teeth to the bullwhip of its tail, where lethal spikes jutted. Its battle-scarred abdomen was rusted brown, but the bulk of it was black as tar. Arrows sliced from the watchtowers and clattered off its scales. Arrows were useless. Muskets were useless. It was not just any worm, not just any high western. No one living had laid eyes on this creature, but Ead knew its name. Fyrdell. He who had called himself the right wing of the Nameless One. Fyrdell, who had bred and led the draconic army against humankind in the grief of ages. He was awake. The beast wheeled over Ascalon Palace, casting the lawns and orchards into shadow. Ead sickened, and her skin burned, as his smell inflamed the Sidon in her blood. Her longbow was out of reach in her chamber. Years of routine had blunted her vigilance. Fyrdell landed on the Dern Tower, his tail coiled serpentine around it, and his claws found purchase on its roof. Tiles crumbled away, forcing guards and retainers far below to scatter. His head was crowned with two cruel horns, eyes like pits of magma blazed out of the dark.
Sebran Queen!
The sky itself echoed his words. Half of Ascalon must be able to hear them.
Seed of the Shield Heart!
More stone fell from the tower. Arrows skittered off his armor.
Come forth and face your enemy of old, or watch your city burn.
Sebran would not answer his call. Someone would stop her. The Virtues Council would send a representative to treat with him. Fyrdell exposed his gleaming metal teeth. The alabastrine tower was too high for Ead to see its uppermost balcony, but her newly tuned ears picked up on a second voice.
I am here, abomination.
Ead froze.
The fool, the utter fool.
By emerging, Sebran had signed her own death warrant. Screams rang from every building. Courtiers and servants were leaning out of open windows to behold the evil in their midst. Others ran pell-mell for the palace gates. Ead charged up the privy stair.
So, you have awakened, Fyrdell, Sebran said with contempt. Why have you come here?
I come to give you warning, Queen of Innis. The time to choose your side is near.
Fyrdell let out a hiss that raised gooseflesh all over Ead.
My kin are stirring in their caves. My brother, Cometh, has already taken wing, and our sister Helvisa will soon follow. Before the year is out, all our followers will have awakened. The draconic army will be reborn.
Damn your warnings, Sebran hit back. I do not fear you, lizard. Your threats have as much weight as smoke.
Eid heard their words like thunder in her head. The fumes that rose from Firedell were grindstones on her senses.
My master stirs in the abyss, he said, tongue flickering. The 1,000 years are almost done. Your house was our great enemy before, Sebran Barethnet, in the days you call the grief of ages.
My ancestor showed you Inish metal then, and I will show it to you now, Sebran retorted. You speak of 1,000 years, worm. What deceit does your forked tongue tell? Her voice was naked steel.
That is for you to discover ere long.
The worm stretched out his neck, so his head closed in on the other tower.
I offer you one chance to pledge your fidelity to my master, and name yourself Flesh Queen of Innis.
Fire roared behind his eyes.
Come with me now. Give yourself up. Choose the right side, as Iskarlin has. Resist, and you will burn.
Eid looked to the clock tower. She could not reach her bow, but she had something else. Your lies will take root in no Inish heart. I am not King Sagoso. My people know that your master will never wake while the bloodline of the saint continues. If you think I will ever name this country the Draconic Queendom of Innis, you will be bitterly disappointed, worm.
You claim your bloodline shields this realm, Fyadel said, and yet you have stepped out to meet me.
His teeth burned red hot in his mouth.
Do you not fear my flame?
The saint will protect me. Even the most god-drunk fool could not believe Sir Galleon Barethnet would extend a hand from the heavenly court and shield them from a bellyful of fire.
You speak to the one who knows the weakness of the flesh. I slew Sebran the Ambitious on the first day of the grief. Your saint,
Fyadel said, mouth smoking,
did not protect her. Bow to me, and I will spare you the same end. Refuse, and you will join her now.
If Sebran answered, Eid did not hear it. Wind rushed in her ears as she tore across the sundial garden. The archers hit Fyadel with arrow after arrow, but not one pierced his scales. Sebran would keep goading Fyadel until he torched her. The blockhead must really think the wretched saint would protect her. Eid ran past the Alabastrian Tower. Debris cascaded from above, and a guard fell dead before her. Cursing the weight of her gown, she reached the royal library, flung open its doors, and wove her way between the shelves until she hit the entrance to the clock tower. She cast off her cloak, unbuckled her girdle. Up the winding steps she went, higher and higher. Outside, Fyadel still taunted Sebran. Eid stopped in the belfry, where the wind howled through arched windows and took in the impossible scene. The Queen of Innis was stood on the uppermost balcony of the Alabastrian Tower. It stood just southeast of the Dern Tower, where Fyadel was poised to kill. Worm on one building, Queen on the other. In her hand was the ceremonial blade that represented Ascalon, the true sword. Useless. Leave this city and harm no soul, she called, or I swear by the saint whose blood I carry, you will face a defeat beyond any the House of Barethnet has ever exacted on your kind. Fyadel bared his teeth again, but Sebran dared to take another step. Before I leave this world, I will see your kind thrown down, sealed forever in the chasm in the mountain. Fyadel reared up and opened his wings. Faced with this behemoth, the Queen of Innis was smaller than a poppet. Still, she did not balk. The worm had bloodlust in his eyes. They burned as hot as the fire in his belly. Eid knew she had moments to decide what to do next. It would have to be a wind warding. Wardings like this used a great deal of Sidon, and she had so very little left. But perhaps, if she poured her last store of it into the effort, she could work one upon Sebran. She held her hand towards the Alabastrian Tower, cast her Sidon outward, and twisted it into a wreath around the Queen of Innis. As Fyadel unleashed his fire, so Eid broke the chains on her long, dormant power. Flame collided with ancient stone. Sebran vanished into light and smoke. Eid was distantly aware of Trude coming into the belfry, but it was too late to hide what she was doing.
Her senses closed in on Sebran. She felt the strain on her braids of protection around the queen, the fire clawing for dominance, the pain in her own body as the warding gulped away her sidon. Sweat soaked her corset. Her arm shook with the effort of keeping her hand turned outward. When Fyrdell closed his jaws, all was silent. Black vapours billowed from the tower, clearing slowly. He had waited, heart tight as a drum, until she saw the figure in the smoke. Sebran Barethnet was unscathed. "It is my turn to give you a warning. A warning from my forebear," she said breathlessly, "that if you make war against Virtudom, this hallowed blood will quench your fire, and it will not return." Fyrdell did not acknowledge her. Not this time. He was looking at the blackened stone and the spotless circle around Sebran. A perfect circle. His nostrils flared. His pupils thinned to slits. He had seen a warding before. He had stood like a statue as his merciless gaze roved, searching for her, while Sebran remained still. When he looked towards the belfry, he sniffed, and Eod knew that he had caught her scent. She stepped out of the shadows beneath the clock face. Fyrdell showed his teeth. Every spine on his back flicked up, and a long hiss rattled on his tongue. Holding his gaze, Eod unsheathed her knife and pointed it at him across the divide. "Here I am," she said softly. "Here I am." The High Western let out a scream of rage. With a push of his hind legs, he launched himself across the Dern Tower, taking part of the spire and most of its east-facing wall with him. Eod threw herself behind a pillar as a fireball exploded against the clock tower. The cadence of his wings faded away. Eod lurched back to the balustrade. Sebran was still on the balcony, in her circle of pale stone. The sword had fallen from her hand. She had not looked towards the clock tower or seen Eod watching her. When Cone reached her, she collapsed against him, and he carried her back to the alabastrine tower.
"What did you do?"
came a quaking voice from behind Eod. Trude.
"I swore you. What did you do?"
Eod slid to the floor of the belfry, head lolling. Great shudders pushed through her body. The essence in her blood was spent. Her bones felt hollow, her skin as raw as if she had been flayed. She needed the tree, just a taste of its fruit. The orange tree would save her.
"You are a witch!"
Trude stepped away, ashen-faced.
"Witch! You practice sorcery! I saw it!"
"You saw nothing."
"It was aromancy,"
Trude whispered.
"Now I know your secret, and it reeks far worse than mine. Let us see how far you can pursue Trium from the pyre."
She whirled towards the stair, Eod threw her knife. Even in this state, she struck true. Trude was pulled back with a strangled gasp, pinned by her cloak to the doorpost. Before she could escape, Eod was in front of her.
"My duty is to slay the servants of the Nameless One. I will also kill all those who threaten the House of Barethnet," she breathed. "If you mean to accuse me of sorcery before the Virtues Council, I bid you find some way to prove it, and find it quickly, before I make puppets of you and your lover and stab them in the heart. Do you think that because Trium Saliard is in the east, I cannot smite him where he stands?"
Trude breathed hard through her teeth.
"If you lay a finger on him," she whispered, "I will see you burn in Marion Square. Fire has no power over me."
She pulled the knife free. Trude crumpled against the wall, panting, one hand at her throat. Eod turned to the door. Her breath came swift and hot, and her ears rang. She took one step before she fell. Chapter 10. East. Ginnura was all that Tanne had imagined. Ever since she was a child, she had pictured the capital in a thousand ways. Inspired by what she had heard from her learned teachers, her imagination had fashioned it into a dream of castles and tea houses and pleasure boats. Her imagination had not failed her. The shrines were larger than any in Cape Hisan. The streets glistened like sand under the sun, and petals drifted along the canals. Still, more people meant more noise and commotion.
Charcoal smoke thickened the air. Oxen pulled carts of goods. Messengers ran or rode between buildings. Stray hounds nosed at scraps of food. And here and there, a drunkard ranted at the crowds. And such crowds. Tane had thought Cape Hissan busy, but 100,000 people jostled in Ganura. And for the first time in her life, she realized how little of the world she had seen. The palanquins carried the apprentices deeper into the city. The season trees were as vivid as Tane had always been told, with their butter-yellow summer leaves, and the street performers played music that Susa would love. She spotted two snow monkeys perched on a roof. Merchants sang of silk and tin and sea grapes from the northern coast. As the palanquins wound past canals and over bridges, people turned their backs as if they were unworthy to look upon the sea guardians. Among them were the fish people, as commoners disparagingly called them in Cape Hissan, courtiers who dressed as if they had just walked out of the ocean. Some of them were said to scrape the scales off rainbow fish and comb them through their hair. When Tane saw Ganura Castle, her breath caught. The roofs were the colour of sun-blanched coral, the walls like cuttlebone. It had been designed to resemble the Palace of Many Pearls, where the Cycanese dragons entered their slumber each year, and was said to bridge the sea and the celestial plain. Once, in the days when they had possessed all their powers, the dragons had not needed a season of rest. The procession came to a halt outside the Ganura School of War, where the Sea Guardians would be sorted for the last time. It was the oldest and most prestigious institute of its kind, where new soldiers lodged and continued their instruction in the arts of war. It was here that Tane would prove herself worthy of a place in Clan Medushi. It was here that she would exhibit the skills she had honed since she was a child. Thunder rumbled overhead. As she emerged from the palanquin, her legs buckled, sore from being scrunched up for so long. Tarosa laughed, but a servant caught her. "I hear you, honored lady." "Thank you," Tane said. Seeing that she was steady, he held an umbrella over her. The first of the rain drenched her boots as she walked with the others through the gateway, drinking in the grandeur of its silver leaf and sea-blanched wood. Carvings of the great warriors of Cycanese history clustered under its gable, as if hiding from the storm. Tane spotted the long-honored Princess Demai and the first warlord among them, heroes of her childhood. A woman was waiting for them in the hall, where they removed their boots. Her hair was sleeked into a coiffure.
"Welcome to Ganura," she said in a cool voice. "You have the morning to wash and rest in your quarters. At noon, you will begin the first of your water trials. In that time, you will be observed by the honored sea general, and by those who may yet be your kin."
"Clan Medushi," Tane thrilled inside. The woman led them deeper into the school, through courtyards and covered passageways. Each of the sea guardians was shown into a small room. Tane found herself installed on the upper floor, near the other three principal apprentices. Her room looked over a courtyard, where a fish pond was churned to bubbles by the downpour. Her travelling clothes reeked. It had been 3 days since they had last stopped at a roadside inn. She found a cypress bath behind a wind wall. Scented oils and petals floated on the water. Her hair fanned out around her as she sank into it and thought back to Cape Hissan, to Susa. She would be fine. Like a cat, Susa had a way of always landing on her feet. When they were young, and Tane had still made frequent visits to the city, her friend would steal pan-fried lotus roots or salt plums, dashing away like a fox if she was spotted. They would hide somewhere and stuff themselves senseless, laughing all the while. The only time Susa had ever looked afraid was when Tane had first met her. That winter had been long and harsh. One bitter evening, Tane had braved a blizzard with one of her teachers to buy firewood in Cape Hissan. While the teacher argued with the merchant, Tane had wandered away to warm her hands by a bowl of hot coals. That was when she heard the laughter and the broken voice crying for help. In a nearby lane, she found another child being kicked around in the snow by urchins. Tane had drawn her wooden sword with a shout. Even at 11, she had known how to use it. The urchins of Cape Hissan were hardened fighters. One of them had pulled his blade up her cheekbone, aiming for the eye, leaving a scar shaped just like a fishhook. They had beaten Susa, a starving orphan, for eating a cut of meat from a shrine.
Once Tane had frightened off the urchins, she had beseeched her teacher to help. At 10, Susa had been too old to begin an education in the houses of learning, but she was soon adopted by a tender-hearted innkeeper. Since then, she and Tane had always been friends. They had joked sometimes that they might be sisters, since Susa knew nothing of her parents.
"Sea sisters," Susa had called them once. "Two pearls formed in the same oyster."
Tane pushed herself from the bathwater. How she had changed since that night in the snow. If it had happened now, she might have decided that brawling with urchins was no way for an apprentice to behave. She might even have decided that the girl deserved to be beaten for stealing what was meant for gods. At some point, she had started to realize how fortunate she was to have the chance to be a dragon rider. That was when her heart had grown harder, like a ship collecting barnacles. And yet, some part of her younger self remained, the part that had hidden the man from the beach. There would be no second chances if she was tired during her first day of instruction. Tane dried herself with linen, threaded her arms into the unlined robe on the bed, and slept. When she woke, it was still misty with rain, but a stream of sallow light had broken through the clouds. Her skin had dried, leaving her cooler and clear-headed. A group of servants soon arrived. She had not been dressed by anyone since she was a child, but she knew better than to quarrel. The first trial would take place in a courtyard at the centre of the school, where the sea general was waiting. The sea guardians took their seats on tiered stone benches. The dragons were already here, watching them from over the rooftops. Tane tried not to look.
"Welcome to your first water trial. You have been on the road for days, but the soldiers of the High Sea Guard have little time for rest," the sea general called. "Today, you will prove you can use a halberd. Let us begin with two apprentices whose learned teachers speak highly of their skills. Honorable Onren of the East House, Honorable Tane of the South House, let us see who can best the other first."
Tane rose. Her throat felt small. When she reached the bottom of the steps, a man handed her a halberd, a light pole weapon, its handle made of white oak, with a curved steel blade at its end. She removed its lacquered sheath and ran a finger up to its tip. In the South House, the blades had been wooden. Now, at last, she could use steel. Once Onren had received her halberd, they walked towards each other. Onren grinned. Tane wiped her expression clean, even as her palms dampened. Her heart was a trapped butterfly. "The water in you is cold," her teacher had once told her. "When you hold a weapon, you become a faceless ghost. You give nothing away." They bowed. A hush descended in her mind, like the quiet that came at twilight. "Begin," the sea general said. At once, Onren closed the space between them. Tane whirled her halberd into both hands, the blades clashing together. Onren let out a short, loud shout. Tane made no sound. Onren broke the lock and paced backwards, away from Tane. Halberd pointed at her chest. Tane waited for her to make the next move. There had to be a reason Onren had been principal apprentice in the East House. As if she could hear the thought, Onren began to spin her halberd around her body, passing it fluently over her arms and between her hands in a show of confidence. Tane tightened her grip, watching. Onren favored one side. She avoided putting too much weight on her left knee. Tane recalled, distantly, that Onren had been kicked by a horse when she was younger. Emboldened, Tane strode forward, halberd raised. Onren came to meet her. This time they were faster. One, two, three clashes. Onren barked wordless threats with every attack. Tane parried her in silence. Four, five, six. Tane snapped the halberd up and down, using the handle as well as the blade. Seven, eight, nine. When a down cut came, she wielded the halberd as if it were on a pivot, up at one end, then the other, shunting the blow aside and leaving her opponent exposed. Onren only just recovered in time to thwart the next strike. But when she thrust out her weapon again, wind hissed past Tane. One hand flew to her ear, seeking blood, but there was nothing. Her distraction cost her. Onren came at her in a flurry of oak and steel, unleashing her considerable strength. They were fighting for honor, for glory, for the dreams they had nurtured since they were children. Tane clenched her teeth as she danced and dodged, sweat drenching her tunic, hair stuck to her nape. One of the dragons let out a huff.
The reminder of their presence stiffened her determination. To win this, she would have to take a hit. She let Onryn knock her arm with the handle, hard enough to bruise her. The pain went deep.